from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. In his speech to the nation last night, President Obama renewed his call for a clean energy future. But what will it take to actually get there? Both energy and climate legislation remain stalled in the Senate, so it's not clear yet whether the ongoing crisis in the Gulf will prompt legislative action. But here in California, there is a specific renewable energy goal. Last year, Governor Schwarzenegger signed an executive order establishing a goal of getting 33% of our power from renewable energy sources by the year 2020. Is that goal realistic? In the hour ahead, we'll talk about the push for renewable energy here in California and the obstacles that stand in its way. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. President Obama's Oval Office address last night attempted to spell out how the government will contain the current disaster in the Gulf, but the address was also his call to action.
The tragedy unfolding on our coast is the most painful and powerful reminder yet that the time to embrace a clean energy future is now.
Whether the disaster will prompt clean energy legislation in Washington is anyone's guess. But more than half of the states are already pushing ahead on the renewable energy front, and California's goals are more ambitious than most, netting 20% of our power from renewable sources by the end of this year and 33% of our power from renewables by 2020. In this hour forum, we look at how far along California is in achieving that goal and what the obstacles are both here and nationwide to achieving the clean energy future the president called for last night. Joining us, Dan Kamen. He's professor of energy at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-director of the Berkeley Institute of the Environment. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Happy to have you back. Ted Nordhaus joins us as well, chairman of the Breakthrough Institute, a political think tank based in Oakland that works on these issues. Also author of Breakthrough, Why We Can't Leave Saving the Planet to Environmentalists. Ted Nordhaus, good morning.
Morning, Dave.
Craig Miller is here, too. He's senior editor of KQED's Climate Watch Project. You can find his blog at kqed.org/climatewatch. And also a new series on this topic you can find at kqed.org/33by20. Craig, good morning.
Morning, Dave.
Well, let's begin with a kind of once around on the president's speech last night, and in particular, his call to action as far as a renewable push. Dan, when you heard him speak about that last night, were you satisfied with what he had to say?
I think he said all the right things. He started from the immediate response to disaster, highlighting the National Guard on the ground, what he was doing himself. I had a briefing from his team from Air Force One earlier in the day, actually. And they are engaged. And then he did move into the need for secure energy and climate legislation. I think he left essentially all of the juicy details for later discussion, which is a little troubling because we are at a point where we need to get into those. And there is important proposals on the Senate and House floor. But he said the right framing words. He didn't say the right or he didn't say enough of the action words.
And would you concur with that, Ted Nordhaus? I mean, not surprisingly, he did leave out things like, you know, a carbon tax. That is not, as I say, surprising. Would you have liked to have seen him get into more detail?
Well, I think it would have been I guess it depends on the detail. I think what was most notable, and a lot of people have noted this, is that not only did he not mention a carbon price or a carbon tax, he didn't mention cap and trade, which is the centerpiece of energy and climate legislation currently proposed in the Senate. Now, in my view, that is welcome because certainly in regards to our oil dependence, the current proposal in Congress would have very little impact on oil dependence. I think EPA estimates that we would, under that current proposal in the Senate, use about 4% less oil in 2030 than we otherwise would if it passed. So this is not a recipe for sure to get us off of oil.
One thing also, Craig, is that he didn't I guess there was an implicit sort of call to action in terms of what citizens can do or can't do. But again, not a lot of detail in that area either.
It was very implicit, not at all explicit. I thought it was good that in his action plan he went beyond just dealing with the immediate crisis and did have a call to action to try to get away from this reliance on fossil fuels that we have in this country. But what he failed to do, and I think what some other commentators think he failed to do, is make a connection between the way we live and our dependence on fossil fuels. He said some people suggest we do this and some people suggest we do that, and we'll be taking a look at all this. But there was no ask, you know, what you can do for your country component to this. And a lot of people believe that it's time for that.
Well, let's talk about how we get to that goal. In California in particular, Dan Kamen, there is this rather ambitious goal, one of the most ambitious, though not the most. The most ambitious actually is the state of Maine, which says they're going to have 40% renewable by the year 2017. How realistic is California's plan to get to 33% of renewables by 2020?
Well, California's plan is ambitious at the time it was laid out. It's not actually some of the most ambitious of the plans we're seeing evolving in Europe and elsewhere. It would require organization and coordination. The need to go from our current level of under 20% by a little bit, i.e. just missing this year's target, to 33% in 2020. It's going to require that we prime the pump in terms of research and development using federal money and state money to really push ahead aggressively on the Air Resources Board's plans for sectoral targets in electricity and vehicles, and to get coordinated with other Western states in terms of transmission to make efficiency more of a job one than it even already is, and also to work on this carbon pricing. So it requires coordination and action. But we have a lot of partners in the West that have similar goals. Oregon and Washington are on paths like ours. I don't think it's that much of a stretch if we were coordinated in terms of planning the smart grid, in terms of building out the capacity, and in terms of giving industry clear and long-term goals in terms of what the price of the carbon will be, et cetera. In fact, a lot of my analysis indicates that this is a very reasonable goal, and the big if is, can we couple technology research with policy coordination, and that is the biggie. But I don't regard that as insurmountable at all.
Well, clean energy future is one of those things everyone sort of in principle wants to embrace, Ted Nordhaus. But what are some of the obstacles to get there? Let's walk through. If everyone sort of says, yeah, that seems like a good idea, what hurdles have to be climbed over in order to achieve that goal?
Well, I think the biggest hurdle is that the alternatives to fossil fuels are still a lot more expensive and they're difficult to scale. And there's a bunch of different reasons for that. The biggest just being the, you know, what sort of energy scientists call the issue of energy density. If you look at how much land, for instance, it takes to build a single solar thermal plant that is like the equivalent of a small natural gas plant, it's an enormous amount of land, and that's why we're already very early in this process of trying to scale up clean energy, having these huge battles all over the country to try to site these facilities, whether it's solar thermal plants in the Mojave Desert or the very controversial and famous Cape Wind farm in Nantucket Sound. There's just, given the existing technologies, the costs in comparison to fossil fuels and the enormous sort of amounts of land that are required make it really hard to scale up. And as we start to approach these big targets that California and other states have set, it's going to get harder and harder.
Well, let's focus in on that particular problem first, perhaps, then, the kind of not-in-my-backyard issues that this always prompts, whether it is the famous case in off of Cape Cod or the kind of things that Ted is describing, Craig Miller. Give us a specific example. As you've begun to report on this in the series that you're developing for KQED, what are some of the consequences that people will have to accept if we're going to have a big solar-generating power grid, for example?
Well, there's a great example, a kind of case study we're looking at right now, as part of our 33 by 20 series that Climate Watch is doing in collaboration with Quest, KQED's science unit, Andrea Kissick and I are co-reporting a kind of case study with a company called SolarGen, which is trying to build out a major, like we're talking 2,000 acres of panels, a major solar array in a little valley that very few people even know about in San Bernardino County called Pinoche Valley. And SolarGen thinks it's the ideal place for this because it's so much closer, first of all, to where the power is used than these sites down in the Mojave. There's transmission lines running right through the valley. The valley itself, due to a quirk of meteorology, gets they claim 90% of the solar potential of the Mojave. So here is, as Mike Peterson, the CEO of Solargen, put it to me, you know, he brought in a consulting engineer, went down to the valley and said, God made this valley to produce solar power. But God, if you will, also left some other things there. Ecologists will tell you that that valley is a microcosm. Virtually all the species that existed in the greater San Joaquin Valley, okay, not grizzly bears, but pretty much everything else, are still in this little valley. It's considered a real valuable kind of pool of threatened and endangered species.
So potentially you have sort of environmentalists versus environmentalists?
Exactly. And this is happening all over the state. And it's taking years in some cases for these projects to get through the permitting process under California's Environmental Quality Act, which requires mitigation plans for any endangered species that might be there. Now, multiply this. I'll give you an example. They have a team of, I think it's up to about 20 or 30 biologists combing this valley floor looking for these species. They've been out there for weeks. And that's just one consideration. They also have to look at water, dust, noise, and a lot of other impacts of a six-year construction project building this thing out. Now multiply that by, the last time I checked, something like 240 renewable energy projects that are currently going through the permitting process in California. And we have a patchwork of oversight, too, where the California Energy Commission is responsible for some of them. The counties are responsible for some of them. The CPUC is responsible for some of them. Some of them are shared responsibility. And so I think this speaks to what Dan Kamen was talking about with the coordination factor.
I want to get to some of those obstacles, both technical and governmental, in terms of the permitting process. But Dan Kamen, weigh in, if you would, also on this, I guess, more cultural and political and not in my backyard sort of problem that will have to be overcome. Because again, I think in principle, if you walked around your neighborhood, everyone would say that's a great thing. But if you think about how that might impact your neighborhood, if it's next door to you, it's a different problem.
Well, I don't want to belittle in any way the real concerns over land use, but I do think this is overblown to some degree. We've seen other studies by the Nature Conservancy and other groups looking at energy generation potential in the Mojave, finding areas that are degraded lands already that are useful in these areas. And so getting lots of energy in any system has different issues. And renewables are lower energy density per unit area, both solar and wind, than is having a nuclear power plant or a gas-fired power plant. But the benefits in terms of local jobs, in terms of the climate issues, I don't think this is as big an issue. I think it's an issue now because we don't have the rules in place to do those environmental impact assessments. We have one interesting bill that's in its early stages, Senate Bill 375, that makes communities look at these things. But I also think that the real fundamental here issue is that trying to do this as a patchwork of individual pieces is the start we have to make, because that's where we are, and that's why California's AB 32 plan has lots of sectoral targets. But ultimately, this pricing on greenhouse gas emissions and also pricing on using water, et cetera, has to be part of the story. When that happens, I believe we're going to see much more innovation in how we figure these things out. So this is really an issue, in my opinion, of very serious and important growing pains, but it's not an issue that makes this target in any way unreachable.
Ted Norhaus.
Well, I'd have to disagree with Dan a little bit. I think that the importance of carbon pricing is really overstated. That's not to say we shouldn't have a carbon price, but I think the kinds of carbon prices that we see proposed here and also in the European Union, there's very little evidence that they're going to drive significant deployment of new clean energy technology. That's been the case in the European Union, where there's very little evidence that those policies have been the drivers of the deployment of clean energy there. If you look at the analysis of the various climate bills in Congress, there's very little evidence that they will deploy significant amounts of new clean energy technology over the next two decades. And that's because, again, you have a huge cost difference when you really get down to it between the existing technologies and these new clean energy technologies. And the kind of carbon pricing that we're talking about, that any political system in the world has been willing to tolerate, is not enough to drive this transition or to drive the kind of innovation that we would need to do it.
Well, let's pursue that about what the costs will be, pocketbook costs to consumers. Because, again, if you're concerned about the not in my backyard phenomenon, you're even going to be more concerned about the pocketbook questions, perhaps. I heard Joe Lieberman on the news this morning say, Craig Miller, that the cost of his bill, the Carrie Lieberman approach, would be less than $1 a day per consumer. Can you give us some sense of what the costs will be as we move to a more renewable future?
The estimates are all over the board, depending on where they come from. And remember, there's two bills sitting there in Washington right now. There's a House bill and a Senate bill. Each one of them treats cap and trade a little differently.
There's also the Dick Lugar Republican bill and another bill by Susan Collins.
And on it goes. And then two major bills, I should say. But then there's the California law, AB 32, which is under attack right now, by the way, which creates its own cap and trade, carbon trading setup. All of those, I think the consensus is that at least at first, and Dan is a much better guy to answer this definitively than I am, but I think at least at first, people will see an increase in their electric rates. Most of these schemes, though, come with mechanisms to try to rebate, some of that back to consumers and sort of, minimize the pain, if you will.
Dan, your take on the pocketbook consequence?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, essentially, even though there's a wide range of analysis and some ideological positions on it, almost all the estimates say the initial costs will be high. California, though, is positioned to do very well in this process in the sense that we are a locus of the job creation part of the story and, maybe more importantly, even job and intellectual property and industry creation. I mean, many of these companies will have hubs, headquarters, offices built here. There's a real benefit to initiating those operations in many of these companies that would come along. And I think that the most important part of the story is that California, I believe, really has got it right in terms of a mix, again, if they can stick to it, which I certainly hope we can, in that there are strong sectoral targets in the short run. There are mandates for a certain amount of renewables in the mix state by state, and then there's this longer-term process to develop the carbon market. And I guess I would push back on the assessments that a price on carbon isn't going to drive things. We're at a stage, essentially, where we're creating a new currency. And so we have targets and mandates in the short term to get these things launched. But in the long term, you don't want to be subsidizing lots of little individual pieces. You want an equation that balances out the full range of benefits and costs. The U.S. military, for example, values a barrel of oil on the battlefield at over $1,000, and that's because of all the logistics and costs, to say nothing of environmental or other features. We don't have any of these costs, not only the greenhouse gas costs, but also the costs in terms of asthma, local air pollution, from our fossil fuel use. We are going to need to tip that equation towards these broader costs. And I think that California is a strategy that uses sectoral targets in each area in the beginning and goes towards that longer-term vision. That's an equation that leads to job creation and, in fact, in some assessments, to lower long-term costs than we would have in a business-as-usual plan. So I think there are real opportunities here. It does require this coordination of technology development, implementation, and policy, and that's really what's being challenged right now, and that's what the president tried to highlight as something we need to get back on the front burner.
Dan Kamen, professor of energy at the University of California, Berkeley. Craig Miller, you hear this phrase a lot, putting a price on carbon, and to tell you the truth, I'm never really sure what that means. So what does it mean?
It means making it more expensive than the alternatives. In other words, if you put a tax on a gallon of gasoline, that's putting a price on carbon in a sense, and it's creating a disincentive to use gasoline.
And is it also factoring in some of the other kind of residual consequences that Dan Kamen was describing, the health costs and all the rest? It's somehow coming up with a calculation for what the real cost of depending on fossil fuels are?
People are beginning to do more of that they're realizing, quite frankly, the people who are proponents of carbon pricing and decarbonizing in general are beginning to realize that to sell this notion, they need to appeal to things that are higher on the radar of individual households, like energy security, like public health. And they're starting to talk more about things like local air pollution issues and other things that have both a greenhouse gas component you know, and a public health component.
I want to ask something about the further obstacles to get there. We've talked some about the not in my backyard, the question of how much this will cost consumers. You've also, some of you have also referenced the sort of complicated permitting process that you have to go through. Jonathan Alter, whose new book about the Obama first year in office is called The Promise, will be our guest in the second hour. But there's a reference he makes in the book that I thought was interesting about this problem, which he says that in the early days of creating the stimulus, Ted Nordhaus, they wanted to do more. They wanted to put more into this, but it was too hard. It was too complicated. The patchwork that you have to weed your way through in terms of permitting and regulations was just too dense. They couldn't do it. Walk us through some of the nature of that particular problem.
Well, this refers specifically to the administration, as part of the stimulus, really wanted to make a big investment in upgrading the grid, literally building high power transmission lines out to the Dakotas or the Mojave Desert or wherever, so you can move this power from the optimal places to generate it, where there's lots of wind or lots of sun, to the places where we need to use it. And in many cases, that may mean moving it for hundreds or even thousands of miles. And Obama himself came back to his team multiple times and said, you guys need to figure out how to do this, how to get this done, because this is an obvious thing to do with stimulus. And his team again and again and again came back to him and said, we can't figure out how to do this. There's just a thicket of regulatory and jurisdictional and other just
technical standards,
all sorts of obstacles to doing this. And at least in the context of a stimulus, where the ostensible purpose was to create jobs over a course of a couple of years, they couldn't figure out how to get it done.
And is that a big obstacle even within a single state, Craig Miller, to kind of weed your way through the California process in particular?
Well, I think that if you even just look at what's going on with smart meters right now, these new digital meters that they need to deploy in order to have this smart grid concept that they keep talking about,
This is not to be confused with the smart meters that are so controversial with PG&E.
It is the same smart meter I'm talking about. You know, this is a key component to this new age of, you know, a smart grid and intelligent distribution and more efficient distribution of electricity. But they've had a really hard time rolling them out. You know, the deployment has been rough, at least for this one utility, I should say, because the two major utilities in Southern California have managed to do it more smoothly. But already, this one little device that's so essential to the system has become hugely controversial, at least in a good portion of the state. So the technical barriers are, you know, I mean, they need to be recognized. And another thing about that I think we need to talk a little bit about here is that there's a sense in the business and investment community that they're, you know, business likes certainty, investors like certainty, and people are waiting for somebody to tell them what the rules are going to be. And I mean, I heard a guy from Deutsche Bank say just last week there is, you know, quote, massive amounts of capital waiting to be deployed into these new technologies once somebody just tells them what the rules are going to be.
Craig Miller, senior editor for KQED's Climate Watch. The new series on this is called 33 by 20. If you're interested in that, you can go to kqed.org/33 by 20. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your calls and emails on this question. What are your thoughts about the renewable future? How will we get there here in California? How do we climb over some of these obstacles that our guests have been describing? Here's the number if you want to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, add your comments there, or you can email them to us at forum@kqed.org. Back with more from Dan Kamen at the University of California, Craig Miller from Climate Watch here at KQED, and Ted Nordhaus of the Breakthrough Institute in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, renewable energy. The president last night in his speech to the nation talked about the need to get to that clean energy future. And we're talking this morning about how we get there, particularly in California, which has a stated goal of getting to 33% of its power consumption to come from renewables by the year 2020. We're joined by Dan Kamen at the University of California, Berkeley, Craig Miller, senior editor for KQED's Climate Watch program, Ted Nordhaus, chairman of the Breakthrough Institute, and we're joined on the phone as well right now by Michael Picker, who is the governor's senior advisor here in California for renewable energy facilities. Mr. Picker, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Right before our break, Michael Picker, we talked a little bit about the obstacles involved in getting to that goal, which the governor put into effect with his executive order last year, and one of the obstacles being the permitting process that has to go that people have to go through if they're going to create some of these new renewable energy sources. How do you view that permitting process?
It's painful. It's confusing. It's conflicting. It's torturous. It's very hard to navigate.
Other than that,
that makes it sound like a significant obstacle. What are you doing to try to make it simpler?
Well, many of these projects that I'm focused on are fairly large. They cover a big footprint in order to be able to capture enough sun and wind to be able to supply power at the utility scale, the 200 megawatts or above projects that I'm working on. And so frequently they are on public land, which involves Bureau of Land Management. They are solar thermal, which involves California Energy Commission. They'll have impacts on a variety of sensitive habitats and species that involve the federal U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the California Department of Fish and Game. So we've created a renewable energy action team by agreement between the governor and the Secretary of the Interior. They actually signed that agreement at the end of 2008, and people have been working together for quite a while. So having said how complicated these processes are, because we have to match federal NEPA and California CEQA environmental reviews.
And briefly, what do those acronyms stand for?
California Environmental Quality Act is popularly or unpopularly known as CEQA, and NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is a national environmental review law. Both require kind of beginning to end, cradle to grave review of the impacts of projects and consideration of alternatives and then mitigating activities. But they do it in slightly different ways, and they have slightly different processes. So the challenge is to really try to overlap them, streamline them by using the same information, certainly not by cutting any of the underlying environmental values or ignoring problems.
And Dan Kamen, you mentioned earlier that you felt that the not in my backyard concern and some of those sorts of worries sometimes get overly dramatized and are overstated. What's your view on this particular obstacle?
So I didn't mean it was overstated. I mean, it is a real change in planning. But what I do think is that we have to work through to clarify these rules and to make them cleaner for developers of all sizes. That process requires a sort of coordination that Mr. Picker's office does, that we do with the Public Utilities Commission and with the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I think that's a process that needs to be one of those boring, wonkish features that is critical to facilitating all these projects. And I think that's really that's the behind-the-scenes aspect that can make a great deal of these projects go. So,
and that also, Dan Kamen, it seems at fundamental odds in some ways with the kind of urgency of the moment. When you heard President Obama speak last night about what has to be done, both now in terms of the Gulf but in the future, there's not a lot of, I guess, tolerance is there for that sort of wonkish, deliberative process?
There isn't, and I don't think that there should be a lot of patience for this, because it really is a question of will and action. I think the thing that's helpful, though, is that there are a whole number of very good projects in the pipeline and the queue already. I guess I shouldn't say pipeline these days.
Yeah.
But in the queue to be done now, and implementing those while working out regional coordination. Right? The governor's office has been very active with this critical group, the Western Governors Association, and in fact, Canada and Mexico are involved. So we have good projects to move forward on now that we need to do that will generate green jobs, and we need to clarify these rules. And this is really a critical part of the story in that while everyone would like to say the federal government should sort of clean the way here, we have essentially 40 years of energy and environmental history and legislation that indicate that these innovations And these coordinations happen first at the more local levels, state and even cities and counties, and the good features get picked up at the federal level. So the mantle and the need for California and its partner states in the region to move this ahead is absolutely vital. Those discussions need to go more quickly, but they are undergoing. They are taking place right now.
And let's hear what our listeners think about this topic. We'll go to Matthew first in San Francisco. Matthew, go ahead.
Yes. The first off, I wanted to clarify that oil is not a factor in electric generation. So when we're talking about oil spill type things, oil is used for transportation, not generation. But more importantly, I want to talk about the fundamental assumption in a lot of this conversation that clean energy has to be done at utility scale. So a single house needs about 43 square feet of solar panel in California to run itself. If you try to put it in the Mojave Desert, then you're talking millions of square feet. But we already have developed land in the form of houses. And the question is, how do we change the system to incent using already developed land to generate power?
Matthew, interesting point. Thanks for raising that. A number of people, Craig Miller, are emailing in on that same question that Matthew raises. Tom writes, and why not create a federal loan program so homeowners can switch? Someone else writes, the energy bill has section in it that requires homeowners to bring their homes up to different energy standards. Another person writes in about what about how we get panels on the roofs of everyone's existing house? So a lot of interest in terms of making this happen in your neighborhood in a small way, as opposed to the giant way that you were describing before in the Mojave Desert.
Well, two things on that. First of all, starting next year, I believe it is, the rules for what they call net metering have been liberalized, and so the utilities will actually have to start cutting you a check for the power that you can generate on your rooftop and sell back to them, whereas now they're just crediting your bill and then kind of zeroing that out at the end of the year. So that could be a big improvement, a much bigger incentive. But also you've tapped into yet another controversy, which is this distributed power idea and whether we can actually get there by putting solar panels on everybody's roofs and instead of big build-outs in the Mojave. Some people think that we can. Others don't think so.
Ted Nordhaus, weigh in on that point.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, the first thing to recognize is that there are already huge subsidies for solar panels to put them on your roof. If you decide to do that, there's enormous tax credits, all sorts of other benefits, and it's still really expensive. And if you look at the difficulty that the state of California has had scaling up its million solar roofs program, you see that. And again, the problem is that you have an underlying technology that is still really inefficient and expensive. If you look at the solar efficiency of those panels without getting them dramatically improving the solar efficiency, I think you're going to have a hard time scaling this at any cost that anyone's really willing to pay.
And Dan Kamen, just a quick thought of that, and then I want to hear more from our listeners, because this also, what Ted just mentioned, brings us to the point of research, really, and how we need to invest more in figuring out how to do this in the most efficient way.
We do need to invest more in research. The president has laid out the first major uptick in research and development spending in a while. But we have a lot of options here already. We have seen the prices of solar, in particular, and wind as well, dropping dramatically. We do have a mix of technologies. This idea that we can be deploying on rooftops is absolutely true. The federal government is about to release a roadmap for the solar future, for large solar facilities and small distributed rooftop ones, that looks at solar to be up to 20% of our electricity by 2030. That's actually the same roadmap that was released 2 years ago for wind, and we have good evidence from parts of Europe and some parts of the U.S. that we could probably achieve that. So we absolutely need this research and development process to be continued, not just for a couple years, but for long term. But the prospects of bringing these costs down and of using things like property-assessed clean energy financing, something we developed here in Berkeley, to allow property owners to install efficiency first and then solar and other technologies afterwards at no upfront cost. There are, I think, remarkable innovations that are coming out of the California process, the process that brought us AB 32. So I don't see this as a gloom scenario. It's one where, again, coordination, investing in research, but also deploying what we have now can get us a long way, and that is a job generator here.
And two more of our listener thoughts and comments. Al in Palo Alto. Go ahead, Al.
Yes, good morning. I wondered if your guests can comment on the effectiveness and likelihood of a feed-in tariff based incentive in the U.S., which drove quite a bit of the wind and solar development in countries like Germany and Spain.
Okay, feed-in tariffs. Now, Ted, can you comment on that? I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, a feed-in tariff is a much more direct subsidy for deploying solar power. And I think it's a good contrast to much of what we're talking about both here in California and at the national level, where there's talk of, well, we'll have a carbon price, this sort of indirect price signal that will kind of get the market to magically produce these technologies. Well, the reality is that what's worked in virtually every case to significantly scale up deployment of these new technologies are things like feed-in tariffs, where...
Explain what that is, Ted. I'm still not getting it.
So a feed-in tariff is basically... it's a direct subsidy. It's a guaranteed price to those who install solar panels, you know, 35 or 50 cents a kilowatt hour, a very very direct economic incentive. People can do very, very well economically when they install these panels. So it's a huge subsidy for installing solar panels. And when you look at Germany and Spain and other places that have really sort of largely taken over a lot of the solar industry, it's because these subsidies, which dwarf anything being proposed in Congress right now or in California, have been in place.
I was reading an article about how much has been done in Europe compared to the United States. The average European emits, if that's the right way to put it, half the carbon of an American. Building standards in Germany use a third less, so forth and so on. On the other hand, Ted Nordhaus, it's hard to look at the European economy right now and say, well, that's the way we ought to go.
Well, I think there's a couple of important issues there. The first is that they emit less now, but you know, if you went back to 1970, they emitted less then as well. And if you really looked at the countries that have significantly over the last 40 years really cut their carbon footprint, the carbon intensity of their economy, there's really only two that significantly, really significantly have done that. It's France and Sweden. And this is sort of the thing that a lot of folks in the sort of renewable energy space don't like to talk about. But the two places that have really made significant headway on that have done it with nuclear power and also, in the case of Sweden, a lot of hydro.
Let's hold on nuclear power for a moment. We should get back to it because there's an interesting question that we should raise about where are we going to get the most? Is it solar? Is it wind? Is it biomass? Or do we have to revisit nuclear power, as President Obama has indicated he's willing to do? Let's come back to that question because I want to get another view from a listener, and then we'll come back to that point as well. Randy in Santa Rosa. Go ahead, Randy.
Gentlemen, good morning. It seems like last year, about the same time, the same program was on the air, different people, but same topic. And this is like the healthcare plan taking a lot of conversation. But it seems like we're talking about the same stuff. And I believe the bottom line is the big utility companies kind of holding their feet in the dirt and don't get on board and make this happen. Maybe it might take an executive order from the president and just say, all right, let's get on with it, and we'll figure it out as we get on the line. But it seems like we're doing a lot of talking, and nothing's happening.
Randy, thanks. Michael Picker, you want to pick that up from someone who's working in government about whether or not you're having to drag the utilities along for this? What are the obstacles from that standpoint?
I don't find the utilities are a problem. I think that most of the issues are that they're green on green issues. We have a very stringent and effective set of environmental review programs and species protection programs that really were aimed at a different era, and now we're trying to address new challenges. So it becomes a matter of trying to work to try to make them effective and efficient without cutting the underlying environmental values. And so that's really a task that isn't policy. It's more how do you get people to work together on a timely basis? And so we've got a system that is working. We'll get most of the 22 large-scale projects that I've been tasked with working on through the land use permitting process and through the species protection programs in time to qualify for this federal stimulus programs. But I got to tell you that it's really an effort that's pulled together through duct tape, a chewing gum, and spit, and a lot of sweat. So it'll work, but it's not the best policy that we're capable of. It's just the best we can do on deadline.
Michael Picker, who is the governor's senior advisor for renewable energy facilities. A couple of thoughts coming in from some of our listeners via email. Adelia writes in, millions of acres of pristine desert are threatened by fast-tracking environmental procedures because of the stimulus money that is offered until December 2010. It's not necessary to put the installations in pristine desert when there is plenty of already ruined desert closer to cities, similar to a point that Dan Kamen was making earlier about taking advantage of places that aren't necessarily pristine. Let's talk about the elephant in the room that we haven't talked about, nuclear power, whether it makes sense to think about that more as opposed to wind and solar and biomass and all the rest. Dan Kamen, a quick thought?
Well, I'm a professor of nuclear engineering, so yes, I have a view on this one. I think that the phrasing of the question is unfortunately wrong. I mean, we certainly need to look at nuclear. It is a technology that can provide baseload power in large amounts. There are debates about what the costs are. We have a process right now at the federal level that is reviewing our single storage option at the Yucca Mountain facility. But we also have massive, on the order of $54 billion of loan guarantees on the table for near-term nuclear power plants. And we have a process called Gen 4, Generation 4, to try to design a set of those six sort of very promising technologies in the pot as things that we would deploy after 2030. They all have various advantages for electricity, for hydrogen production that would then get us into vehicles, et cetera. No question we need to look at it. The thing, though, is that the idea that we're playing one off versus the other, I think, is the wrong way to think about this. The idea that we would be doing something like we're doing now, 20% of energy from electricity from nuclear, potentially 20% from wind, 20% from solar, fossil fuels with carbon capture. These are all technologies where we want them all to compete in. And while we can design policies for individual ones, such as the feed-in tariffs that I'm very much in favor of for some of the smaller and medium-scale renewables, we really do want to find ways to level out the playing
field. Is that
needs to be part of that conversation.
Yeah. Ted Nurhaus, is that the right mix to you, the sort of 20-20-20 that Dan Kamen was describing?
Well, we can argue about the exact mix. I mean, I think you're going to need a range of low and zero carbon technologies to get anywhere close, certainly, to the sort of scientifically based targets for emissions reductions that everybody's talking about.
And nuclear has to be part of the mix?
There is really very few credible energy analysts who can look at what it will take to get there and conclude that you're not going to need a lot more nuclear power. And I would just add to that, you know, I think really following on Dan's comments, I mean, you're going to need a bunch of these technologies, and every one of them has both big technological obstacles in terms of needing to be much better and big NIMBY obstacles, we need to deal
exactly
with those directly.
I mean, Craig Miller, that's where I was going next. I mean, you were bringing up the not-in-my-backyard problems that are relating to the place you and Andrea Kissick are reporting on with solar in Southern California. But when it comes to not-in-my-backyard concerns, that's nothing compared to what you will face if you start doing more with nuclear.
Well, that's right. And they've just passed a new rule now in California that you can't use seawater for the most part or rivers for the cooling process. And all of California's nuclear power plants are on the coast and use seawater. I say both are on the coast and use seawater for cooling.
To Kevin in San Francisco. Kevin, go ahead. Your thoughts.
Hey, I'm hearing a lot about producing new power and the ways to do it, but I've heard nothing about the big elephant in the room, and that is making the appliances we have run more efficiently. We have parasitic power, so-called standby power. How many of you leave your computer monitors on? In the next 20 years, electronic gadgets like cell phones are going to consume three times more electricity than they do today. That's like 280 gigawatts of generating capacity. Where's the federal mandate to make more efficient products?
Kevin, great point. Craig Miller.
Well, this is supposedly the highest priority of the current Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, who came from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, of course, is to seize what he calls the low-hanging fruit, these so-called negawatts. I mean, the cheapest form of energy is that that you never have to use. And in President Obama's speech, you know, it was somewhat startling to me to hear him say, some say we should raise the efficiency standards of government buildings. Well, that seems like a no-brainer to me. So I absolutely agree with the caller. We need more emphasis there.
Again, Dan Kamen, how do we – is this a significant part of how we get there from here to make whether it's refrigerators more efficient or building standards, which is part of the bill that Senator Lugar from Indiana has put forward?
It absolutely is. I mean, we know from experience in California and in the country, but very greatly here, that this is not only a least cost, but it's often a fastest deploy and a fastest payback technology. It's lots of little things from the light bulbs to the better water heaters to smart windows. All of these things need to be in there. And it's absolutely right that the president didn't emphasize this enough. The state of California has a quite aggressive plan. It is something, though, where the state has been pushing and will continue to push, but it's going to need alliances to make appliance standards go up. California has pushed hard, but we need to see federal action. There has been a lot of effort at the Department of Energy and various programs, but we're not seeing yet the big appliance manufacturers announcing lower numbers in response to these standards. So this has to be an area where the state and the federal government really push much harder than they've done so far, because there's a lot of opportunity here.
And to Harvey in Berkeley. Harvey, go ahead. You're on.
Hi there. Well, the fight against AB 32 is sponsored by two gasoline refiners out of Texas. I think one is Valero. And so that makes sense that the oil companies are fighting clean energy. That's who the battle is. And as far as technology is concerned, I feel that I'm going with the technologies that don't use water, because hydroelectric power plants, oil-fired natural gas, nuclear, and coal-fired plants all use 136 billion gallons of our fresh water daily in the production of dirty greenhouse gas-producing electricity, and photovoltaics, thermoelectrics, photovoltaics, light-to-electricity, piezoelectric, pressure-to-electricity, thermoelectric, that's heat-to-electricity, wind power. None of them use water, so I'm moving towards the kind of energy that doesn't use water, so California can preserve its natural water resources.
Harvey,
so
thanks. Thanks for the thought and the recommendation. Some other email comments coming in. Richard from Albany writes, I know the economists always want to use pricing and the market to get the most efficient results, but in the rich United States, is that enough to really reduce consumption of energy, especially in the short run? A Newsweek article this week talked about the societal cost of gasoline, but suggested that even if gas were much more expensive, we would still probably use a significant amount. Michael in Berkeley, while I am completely in favor of renewable energy, I've heard more than once from credible sources that a solar panel has never been produced that generates more energy than it takes to produce. I hope that's not true. Anyone explain?
That's not true.
Okay. Not true, Michael. Not true. So don't worry about that part of it.
I heard Dan chime in on that, too.
Matt writes in, I'm involved with Marin Clean Energy, and at utilities, at least PG&E are definitely a large part of the problem. Utilities make a return for their ratepayers. They can issue massive bonds because of the reliable revenue stream. As a result, they must choose large-scale projects that consume capital in order to create the rate case that they need to grow. And Sarah writes, what about the source materials for the solar panels? Aren't there significant issues with extraction? Dan, you want to respond to that? I'm not sure what that's about.
Well, yeah, so that's the same question as that energy payback time for solar panels. It's not true. We do need to extract materials. Solar panels are today and used to be made from a variety of sort of exotic metals. There's really a revolution going on in terms of what's called thin film and using much less material. So this is probably not a long-term concern, and the real innovative wave we're seeing in solar means that there's many more materials coming into the field, so that there's not likely to be a bottleneck in one area, as we're seeing discussed right now with lithium for batteries. The other point that was made, though, was what about this kind of ways to to finance and work with utilities. And in fact, this idea of the feed-in tariff that was discussed before is a way to support generators of energy across scales, everything from my individual roof selling power back to a business that sells power back from its solar panels more than it consumes to businesses that get in for this topic in particular. These are all the kinds of things that when I began the show saying that the real issue here is coordination and vision, and California's got a vision. It needs the backing of both federal R&D and some local R&D, but it also needs to deploy in these markets, and that's really where the state machinery and the state cooperation is the critical story to get these programs in place, because we've seen some successes. We've also seen that if you don't stick with it, these things can fade away.
We just have a moment or two left. So last comment from each of you about what we need to focus on most, realizing Dan's point that you don't want to frame this as either or. We either do this or don't do that. But where our focus needs to be. Michael Picker, a quick thought from you, please.
It really probably can't answer that. The most that I could say is we probably need to work hard to move all these technologies. I will say that I was asked to shepherd 22 large projects through that are qualifying for federal stimulus dollars and providing jobs. It can be done. It's a lot of work. I think we really need to buckle down to it.
And what are you going to be focusing on your series, Craig, that gets at this point of where we need to concentrate our energy?
The first report was kind of an overview of the situation, trying to get to this goal, which is already aired and is available on the website. The next couple of reports, starting on Monday morning, we'll be looking at this case study in Pinoche Valley, but then we'll also be talking about the storage issue, the transmission issue, land use issues, and many more aspects of it.
And Ted Nordhaus, your thoughts on sort of eyes on the prize, yeah. I guess.
Well, we need two things. We need radical innovation, and that means we need to start spending a lot more on clean energy research and development. And Bill Gates just came out and called for a tripling of the current federal budget. And then you need direct public investment to deploy these technologies. That's what's worked around the world to get them deployed. And we need to stop pretending that sort of like if we send some mild price signals, the market's going to take care of the problem.
Sounds like we all need to learn more about feed-in tariff. I'm going to go look it up. Ted Nordhaus, Dan Kamen, Craig Miller, and Michael Picker from the California Governor's Office. Thanks all very much for participating in our program. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.